going to call the third case, 970332, Athlon versus Heritage Mutual Insurance Company, representing the plaintiff. Athlon A is Emmanuel Malunke.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Emmanuel Mwonge, and I represent Antoine Allen, the minor child, in this action against the defendant landlords and the insurance carriers. Antoine Allen was a little shy of 2.5 years old when he became subjected to lead paint, particles, chips, dust, and eventually lead poisoned while inhabiting the dwellings and premises owned by the landlords, as well as those that he and his mother frequented during the time in question forms the basis of this matter. Appellant Antoine was diagnosed as severely mentally retarded by what we contend was the failure to remove lead-based paint from the dwellings owned by the landlords and or their management companies, and where Antoine resided along with his mother, Maxine Thomas. Antoine also resided at premises owned by his aunt, who is not a party to this matter or to this appeal. Because of this, appellant's expectation of ordinary intellectual endeavors and accomplishments are forever impacted upon and are very limited, to say the very least. Your Honors, whether the appellant is compensated for his injury has come down to one single issue, which has devolved the community and the common law from time immemorial. That issue is how we determine how an individual is compensated for his or her injury following injuries sustained by such an individual at the hands of those that are better able to protect such an individual. We contend, Your Honors, that this court should resoundly answer that issue by putting the responsibility of compensating such a victim on those who are best able to prevent such an incident. This court not only would be making a statement and interpretation of existing common law, statutory ordinance, and other regulations, we believe it is the logical thing to do, the fair thing to do, and what is necessitated by the existing law and the state of the law in this jurisdiction. This court should not only answer that issue by placing the responsibility of compensating that harm to those who can best afford it.
Mr. Malunke, if you were writing the opinion, if you were up here, what would you write with respect to the question of what is the duty of a landlord?
The duty, Your Honor, of a landlord is one that comports with what a reasonable person in 1998, in the position of a landlord owning inner-city dilapidated housing vis-a-vis those who are less sophisticated, less educated, and who happen to either visit, frequent, or reside in those premises, that is to say, It is one that does not require that the landlord actually be told by a person on the premises that landlord, here are peeling paints.
Would you require a constructive knowledge or a should have known?
I would require, in essence, a should have, because the state of the knowledge is such that most adult individuals know that lead is a menace to society, that lead was outlawed, and that's the reason why it's no longer used in gasoline, that people who purchase porcelain make efforts to make sure that they do not contain lead, because they know that lead is toxic to the brain, and moreover, kids have a proclivity to engage in hand-to-mouth activity, which cannot always be monitored by their parents. To require the landlord to otherwise, to any standard otherwise, would be penalizing an innocent victim, such as a child, who has nothing to do with where he lives, what kind of housing he chose or his parents chose, who happens to find himself in circumstances such as those.
But Mr. Mwangi, in terms of constructive knowledge, would you simply have a court take judicial notice that it's widespread knowledge among the general public that paint manufactured prior to 1978 has a lead base? Is that all that you would require?
No, Your Honor. I would, in addition to judicial knowledge, also enable a defendant such as the landlords here to defend themselves once. It's not strict liability. That's not what we are advocating, Your Honor. Once the plaintiff has shown that a landlord failed to comply with a statute or ordinance, it then shifts, I would then make the law such that it shifts the burden to the landlord to show that they acted in conformity with the statute for ordinance.
Now, in particular, in this case, and I'll just, I was looking at the brief, the red brief, concerning the Basingers. I believe that's where your client and his mother lived back in 1990. They're making a point that the reason that summary judgment was granted was because there, A, was no knowledge that the Basingers were never notified of the presence of lead, and that they were never advised of the presence of lead paint, nor were they given any orders to correct. And there were, according to this, I'm looking at page 29, that the property was inspected before and during Antoine's and his mother's tenancy, and that they were never advised of the presence of lead paint nor given any orders to correct. So the allegation here, and that's all it is that they never knew about it, and that's why I believe the judge granted a summary judgment, because according to the summary judgment, there was no, the judge indicated that there was no countervailing evidence presented at least at that stage.
That's correct.
Now, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, if that's, okay. Should not there have been some, I'm talking about the motion for summary judgment that Judge Merritt granted. When you hear a motion under, I think it's 802 Rule 6 or that, I may be wrong on the statute, but I know that you have to talk about any material fact, looking at things in the light most favorable to the opponent of the motion. What was brought in at that time to show that they did have not only notice, but that there was something on your side that would have raised a material issue of fact?
Thank you, Your Honor. What was brought and submitted to the court was evidence of citations on the Basingers for failure to correct a condition on the ceiling where paint was cracking and plaster was falling down.
The Basingers had a, that's the had main, a citation?
Yes, cited by the municipal authority, the city of Racine, during the time when Antoine resided on the premises. Also, what was filed with the court was an affidavit or documents indicating, deposition testimony indicating that the mother of Antoine did notify Judith Basinger, the landlord, that the ceiling was leaking, the bathroom was leaking, and that plaster was falling down and that there were paint chips flying. I agree they were not told that the peeling paint contained lead. I'll submit to the court there is no such notice here. Our position is that the court should infer that if the circumstances were such that A, this is an old house, B, it's an inner city dwelling, C, the people occupying it are very unsophisticated vis-a-vis a landlord who is in the business of renting out premises, ought to be on inquiry notice that at the time when he was advised of falling chips and cracked plaster, he should have gone and inquired, find out whether or not the falling plaster presented problems for those that he rented the house to and for those that frequented the house that he rented.
Is the citation that you said that was given to Basinger or Basinger's, is that part of this record?
Yes, it was filed with the trial court.
So you've got it in, it's in the...
It's in the material.
Okay, did that citation make reference to chip paint or flaking of paint?
I believe it made a reference to cracked plaster.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether it went...
Did it make reference to lead?
Beg your pardon?
Did it make reference to lead?
No, Judge. There's no reference to lead to any of the Basingers. All we say is that they should have known that those conditions presented a problem to those that occupied the premises such that, A, they asked themselves, are the health and safety of the occupants of these houses threatened by virtue of the conditions?
Counsel, did I hear you? What I was interested in, you said, and that if I misunderstood, I want you to correct me, you indicated that in that notice, that citation, there was reference to paint chips. Is that correct?
The paint chips is in the deposition testimony. I was referring to the citation for cracked plaster in the bathroom, I believe it was, of the residence at 1013 12th Street.
Counsel, I'm interested in knowing what duty you are asserting that the plaintiffs have. Obviously, the plaintiffs have, as do all people, a duty to exercise ordinary care to...
That's correct, Judge.
The defendants, thank you. The defendants have. They have the duty to exercise ordinary care. But, much like an auto accident case, when we have a defendant driver who has a duty to exercise ordinary care, we say, what kind of duty? A duty not to speed. A duty, you know, were they negligent in speed? Were they negligent in going over the center of the road? Were they negligent in failing to yield? What is the duty that you are asserting that the defendants have in this case, other than the umbrella duty of to act reasonably to all?
Just like in an automobile case where we reference to the rules of the road, there are rules that govern residences and dwellings. The Building Inspection Department of every municipality has codes and regulations.
That's your theory, as I understand it, for a violation of a safety statute is negligence per se. But you have a cause of action other than negligence per se, and if so, what is the duty that you are asserting is breached? Is it the duty to test? Is it the duty to inspect? Is it the duty to try to ascertain and eliminate a danger that should be inferred to knowledge should be inferred to them? What is the duty other than the negligence per se cause of action?
The duty is severalfold, Your Honor. Because the ordinance, for example, in Racine, the ordinance requires that the paint levels do not exceed 0.06% per milligrams per thousand of lead in paint. The only way a landlord would ensure that his paint in his dwellings, that the paint does not exceed those levels, is by checking. There's no way that a landlord could sit and say, well, as long as I'm not cited by the city, I'm not going to do anything. The mere fact that the ordinance prescribes a level of paint above which no paint above which threshold is allowed to be in the dwellings, any reasonable inquiry by any reasonable landlord would lead to the discovery upon testing that the lead paint A is either chipped or chipping or peeling, or and or the paint levels exceed those that are required by the city or by the government or whatever municipality controls the jurisdiction.
Counsel, are you suggesting that every landlord would have the duty to inspect and to test?
Every landlord would have the duty to inspect. However, we've got to look at the facts and circumstances of each case. There are landlords that are, in quote-unquote, at higher risk. For example, landlords who own housing that was constructed during the times when lead was put in paint would have a higher duty because that is a higher risk of finding lead in those.
Tell me how you're connecting that, if you would, to the idea of knowledge. You were talking earlier about the knowledge of Bassinger's as an example, and I understood at least that you were arguing that they had constructive knowledge. Is that correct?
That's correct, Judge.
If you were stating this duty that you want us to adopt, would you state it also in terms of knowledge, actual or constructive knowledge, or how would you tie it to the idea of a duty to inspect and to test?
It would be either one or both, Your Honor. Either, if you find that he had actual knowledge, he or she had actual knowledge, you need not go further. And if one has constructive knowledge, an inquiry may be made beyond that, but not necessarily. In either situation, one is either actually on notice or there's constructive notice. In either event, I think the public, the renting public, would be protected by that duty imposed on that basis.
Now, as I see it, there are three possible duties here, the duties of care. One is that no landlord has a duty to inspect or test for contaminated paint, that is, lead-contaminated paint. So you can buy an old building under that duty to care, dating to 1950, the paint's chipping, but you have no duty to inspect or test contaminated lead at all, period. Another statement of the duty of care could be that a landlord has to take action, that is, to test or remove the paint. If the landlord knows or should have known that there was paint chipping and that the chipping paint contains hazardous lead. Now, according to the circuit court, at least at some point, that was your position there. But it also, the circuit court opinion seems to say, that you also took a third position, which is that the duty of care means a duty to inspect and test for lead paint, even if you have no information that there is lead paint on the premises. I mean, those are three distinct duties. And you get to different results. If there's no duty to inspect or test for contaminated lead, you're out of the picture. I mean, we don't need any affidavits. We don't need anything.
just a claim that the landlord failed to inspect is enough. That there was a duty and then you didn't fill it. The other case is the duty to take action if you knew or should have known. And that's what the trial court seemed to go on for most of this opinion. And then the trial court looks at the affidavits and says they're good enough to show no constructive knowledge. It seems to me there your debate is that it shouldn't have been summary judgment. Is that right?
That's correct. We took the position, Judge, that the circuit court did make findings at the summary judgment level that, in our opinion, ought not to have been made, because in essence it ruled on the credibility of witnesses, examined the credibility or impeached the credibility of an expert witness. Those were issues of fact that are not dealt with at that level.
And whether somebody knows something is a fact, and whether they should have known is a fact too.
That's correct, Judge.
And that's your position. Now, as I understand, at least one of these amicus briefs, they take the position that every landlord has a duty to inspect and test for lead paint, period. Is that your position here?
Yes, Judge.
That's your position, Judge.
It's heightened. The duty is heightened depending on the facts and circumstances of each case. For example, the basing is, and I correct myself, I may have said paint chips. I think that notice that they received had to do with a false ceiling, what they refer to as a false ceiling, repairing a false ceiling. But again, those are circumstances that called for a heightened awareness that circumstances lurked on the premises that required inquiry into as to what they entailed, whether or not they threatened the lives and safety of those that came on the premises. There is no way somebody is going to comply with the regulations, with the ordinance in Racine, with the statute, unless they investigate. We take the position that they have a duty to investigate. They can only discharge that duty by investigating. They cannot discharge any of the duties, either common law duty, statutory duty, or otherwise, without investigating whether or not the circumstances on their premises present a hazard and are in compliance with the regulations.
The chief laid out three possible standards, which I agree, those are alternatives. Is there a fourth one here that we could look at? And that is that a landlord must test or remove if he, number one, has an old house, at least manufactured prior to 1978, and two, knows that there was paint chipping. Nothing more. Then you wouldn't have to show constructive knowledge that the paint contained lead. You'd only have to show that it was an old house and that there was paint chipping.
If the paint is chipping again, the risk is greater and calls for a heightened duty.
But what we're wrestling with here, counsel, is what are our alternatives in terms of a holding, in terms of going from the most lenient towards the landlord to the most severe test against the landlord? And there are probably other alternatives, but at least we've laid out four now, haven't we?
I think the most reasonable one would be the basis of any holding, Your Honor.
Now, just for my information, if we were to find that these homes, or one of them anyway, came under the Safe Place statute, how would that affect any one of these alternatives?
Well, if it comes under the, and we maintain that under the Safe Place statute, violation of which is negligence per se, of course the defendants could always, once the burden have shifted, could show that they complied with that. But that would be an indication to the court that at least one of the duties was violated.
Okay. And would you make that same argument with respect to the violation of the safety statutes and the safety ordinance? Does that create negligence per se and shift the burden as well?
To the extent that those regulations were created for the protection of the harm, the community, and all of that, yes, Your Honor.
Did they do anything else if we were to find that these were violations of the safety? Is there any other benefit that inures to a plaintiff in these circumstances?
I think the benefit...
I claim ignorance, sir.
The overall benefit is to society. in general and in particular to the plaintiff. Here you have a kid who is brain damaged because of lead. The society ends up paying for it because he will never get a job that he can get him to afford to pay for the medical bills. Society ends up paying for that. He is a threat to several households, depending on the extent to which the lead impacts on his head, on his brain as he grows up. I don't know if I'm answering the question, Your Honor, but I see the benefit not only to the plaintiff, particular plaintiff, but to the community as a whole.
Thank you, Mr. Mwangi. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Our schedule shows 15 minutes for Mr. Misero, representing State Farm, 10 minutes for Mr. Yankala, representing Gene Matthews, 5 minutes for Mr. Murray, representing Secura Insurance.
Correct.
Where's Mr. Murray? Thank you. Counsel, you can move up a chair and sit at table if you prefer.
You ask him to sit back there.
That tells us everything. Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Meserol. I represent Gerald and Judith Bassinger of State Farm General Insurance Company as their insurer. As you mentioned, Justice Abramson, I'll be taking 15 minutes, and then the rest of the time will be divided between Mr. Yankala and Mr. Murray.
What's your argument going to be on so we ask you appropriate questions?
Actually, I'm prepared to discuss all issues. Okay. I know the certification dealt with the issue primarily of duty, and that's what I'm going to address first. Time allowing, we'll get into the other issues that were also the subject of this appeal. I do want to take just a brief moment, if I can, to just kind of address some facts that have been misstated in some of the briefs in this case. For instance, in Mr. Mwangi's initial brief filed in the Court of Appeals, he states that the child was diagnosed with lead in May of 1990. That is incorrect. While the various exhibits attached to his affidavit were deemed by the court to be hearsay, for purposes of this argument, there is an article, or there is a page from the medical record of the hospital, which is May of 1991, and that's found at record site 172, and that's exhibit 14. Another thing that needs to be corrected is Mr. Mwangi's statement in his brief, in which he indicates that the plaintiff lived at the property of the Bassingers on 12th Street and was seen from August of 90 to May of 1991. I believe there's a statement somewhere in there he lived there somewhere in 1989, and that is incorrect. He lived there for about 9 months. And again, the time frame of August 90 to May of 91, again, is found in the record exhibit, or record 162. That's at page 8. Also, Mr. Mwangi's reply brief states that Ms. Thomas, the child's mother, contacted the Bassingers about chipping paint from the ceiling, and that is not correct. I specifically asked at a deposition that was record 162, page 9, exhibit C, that when she refers to paint, she's actually talking about plaster. And that brings up another exhibit that was attached to Mr. Mwangi's affidavit. That's exhibit 19. And that, again, although it was not authenticated or certified, is a notice of inspection by the Racine Health Department in March of 91. And the Bassingers were asked to repair / replace false ceiling in bathroom. There is no mention of chipping or peeling paint, nor any mention of the presence of lead.
Can we infer, or isn't Antoine able to take advantage of an inference that if they are told that there is plaster that is coming down, that plaster has probably got paint on it? Isn't he entitled to that inference for purposes of a summary judgment?
He may be entitled to an inference that there's paint, but we have a two-pronged test that we're advocating in this case, that you have to have notice of chipping and peeling paint, and then you have to know or have reason to know that that paint contains lead.
Oh, sure, I understand that. But, I mean, I'm trying to, the point that I'm making is that for our purposes of summary judgment, it really does not make a great deal of difference whether any of these documents or any of the knowledge refers to chips of paint or plaster chips, because, in fact, there's an inference that I think most plaster is painted.
I would agree in the abstract that's correct, but I think under the Scroggins case that we cited in our brief, which involved a hole in the wall, the court, I believe that was a Maryland decision, said that you can't equate a hole in the wall with paint chips. And so, for purposes of your question, the purpose of the summary judgment motion, there has to be some proof that there are paint chips present, number one, and that the defendant landlord has been notified of the existence of paint chips. That's one of the other issues that I wanted to bring up to correct some facts, and that there's some very broad statements that the Bassingers were advised of the presence of chipping or peeling paint. And at the record site 162, exhibits D, C, and E, there is testimony of Ms. Thomas, the child's mother, where she did not advise the Bassingers, and she has no knowledge that the Bassingers had any notice of the existence of chipping or peeling paint.
Wasn't that the mother, or the wasn't it the aunt that advised the Bassingers, or the mother?
Let me disabuse you of that impression. Nobody at any time ever advised the Bassingers of the presence of lead paint.
Oh, of course. He's already conceded that. No, nobody's talking about lead paint. Just the presence of plaster or the presence of paint chips.
The mother testified that she advised them, if I recall correctly, of the presence of plaster. We also acknowledged in the affidavits of the Bassingers themselves that there had been problems with the plaster ceiling, which they had been rectified.
Yeah, as I hear counsel, he's very careful to distinguish, and he concedes that I think he's conceding that at no time were either the Matthews or the Bassingers advised that these paint chips or plaster chips contained lead. He's saying, I think, that they had constructive knowledge that they can.
That's what he's contending. The case law that we've cited that deals with this issue of duty on the part of the landlord says that you have to have some kind of, if you will, it has to be brought home to the landlord. I think it's the Felton case that talks about how you come across knowledge, constructive knowledge, if you will.
Are you asking us to adopt, if I can refer you to page 2 of the amicus brief, where it says a landlord should not be liable absent knowledge or a reason to know, I guess that's the same thing as constructive knowledge, that there is deteriorating paint on the premises and that the paint contains lead.
Correct.
That's the standard that you're asking us to adopt.
Yes, and I think that's in conformance with Wisconsin law on the duty of owners of property. If we take a look at Wisconsin Civil Jury Instruction 8020, which is entitled Duty of Owner or Possessor of Real Property to Non-Trespasser User, it says in part, if an unreasonable risk of harm existed and the owner was aware of it, or in the use of ordinary care, he should have been aware of it. That's the exact issue we're dealing with here. It's not the issue of the chipping paint. It's really the issue of whether or not that owner knew or should have known, or quote-unquote under the restatement, had reason to know that it had lead paint in it.
Counsel, if I may continue, and I'm sorry to take up so much of the court's time, but there is another alternative here besides the three that the chief correctly laid out, and that is we could say that the duty is on if a landlord owns a pre-1978 built house, and if he knows that there is deterioration of paint, he's got a duty to inspect. What's wrong with that?
With all due respect, I think that's very close to the third alternative that Justice Abrams.
Yeah, it's on a line. It's on. What it says is you don't have to know that there's paint chipping. Well, I guess what it says is that.
That it's constructive notice.
Right.
That's what it says.
Constructive. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It removes the constructive notice.
Right. And I think what that
exactly
does is it basically creates, in effect, an absolute or a strict liability situation on the part of the landlord.
No, what it does, may I suggest this? What Justice Babbage's fourth standard is, can be said to be what should have known is. That is, a jury could say that if you know you've got an old pre-1978 building, and if you have paint chipping, that you are then deemed to have known under the law. That's constructive notice. Can't say, close your eyes to it, that's enough to put you on notice that you got a lead paint possibility, and that puts you on the duty to test. Now, if that's not true under should have known, tell me what circumstances would fit under should have known.
Okay. I think there's a number of different ways that somebody, quote-unquote, should have known. For instance, take a look at the Richmond case. In that case, the property owner was a lawyer. So right there, at least he's deemed to be a little more sophisticated than other potential landlords. But more importantly, he also had a property manager who had served as an inspector for the city of Baltimore for 2 or 3 years. This property manager himself acknowledged that he knew that most older homes contained lead. That constitutes, in my mind, should have known. Now, in this case, there is absolutely nothing in this record to establish anything even close to that, that the Bassingers, nor any of the other respondents in this matter, quote-unquote, should have known of the presence of lead paint.
Isn't that a question, though, for the jury? The standard in Wisconsin is, as alluded earlier by Justice Babbage, that the duty of any person is the obligation of due care to refrain from any act which will cause foreseeable harm. That's foreseeable harm, I think, is another way of saying should have known.
And that gets to the issue of constructive notice / should have known.
I mean, what I understand, at least the questioning to be pursuing, is someone who has notice of chipping or peeling paint in a pre-1978 building, it is foreseeable for them that there might be or there may be problems with lead paint.
Is
that a jury question?
No, it's not. The question of duty is a question for the law, number one. Number two...
Well, the duty to maintain a safe premises, okay. That's a duty. Everyone has that duty.
Right.
That duty. Okay.
But
so whether or not they breach that duty is in the framework of is it foreseeable that there was going to be a harm to others? And if there is a pre-78 building with chipping or peeling paint, it's a jury question to whether or not they breach that duty, whether or not it is foreseeable. What's wrong with that?
I disagree because all of the other cases in the other states that have addressed this issue have all very succinctly stated that you can't assume this quote reason to know aspect of the two-pronged test has been met simply because it's an older building or there may be general knowledge in the community that an older building may have lead paint. We specifically pointed out to the trial court an affidavit that I submitted of testimony from Dr. Needleman in another matter in which he indicated that houses before this time, 50% of them had lead, which means 50% don't.
Oh, so that's the duty to test it then.
I'm sorry?
That's your duty to test. You should know that 50% have, 50% don't. You got an equal shot at having it. Why don't you impose on the landlord a duty to test?
I think because in this situation, you're dealing with landlords that financially probably cannot do that. They're dealing with... One of the amicus briefs talk about an XRF machine. You make it sound like you can go out to Walgreens and buy one of these things. They're not available to the general public. I believe there was testimony, I apologize, it's not part of the record, but the city of Racine only had two of these units.
But what if this landlord, I'm asking you a hypothetical, what if a landlord knows that he has an old home, prior to 1978 anyway, but knows, and also knows that the paint is deteriorating and it's chipping in that house. Is that enough to get this case to a trial?
No.
And why is that?
Because he has to have some knowledge of a foreseeable risk of harm. That risk of harm is the lead paint. He has to have notice not only of the deteriorated condition, but he has to have notice that the lead paint has, or the paint chips have lead. And that's where we get into the actual or constructive knowledge or knew or should have known standard, which in my mind, Section 358 of the Restatement of Tort Second is what the cases in Maryland talk about. Our cases in our state talk about actual or constructive knowledge.
What about, so you'd require that they have actual or constructive knowledge that the chips contain lead. What about a little bit lesser standard, that actual or constructive knowledge that the paint chips might contain lead?
Then you're carving out a specific exception to well-established law in the state. To a situation where you've got landlords that might be sued for a question of lead. You're then going to have to carve out a separate exception for radon, fiberglass...
We're talking about lead here. Now, assume I'm a landlord. I own an old home. And I know that that home was built and painted, presumably, in 1960. I also know, because I've been told by the tenants, that there's a terrible paint chipping condition present in the house. And I also know from having read newspapers, etc., that there is a pretty good chance, or at least a 50-50 chance, that the lead, that the paint used contained lead. Are you saying that I have no duty whatsoever to inspect or test?
Under your scenario, no, I don't say that, because you've read articles that have brought the issue of lead home to you.
Okay. As he's apparently argued, he's not your client, but apparently Reverend Matthews said he had.
That is the issue that Mr. Yankow is going to address. As far as my clients are concerned...
He's moving farther away from there.
As far as the know or reason to know issue is concerned, you have to bring some attention or some information home to the landowner. You can't just have information floating around in the sky or rumor or innuendo. And under your scenario, you've read articles about lead. It's the obligation in opposing the summary judgment motion to bring in some evidence to establish that reason to know or constructive notice. That wasn't done in this case, as far as the Bassingers are concerned. My light is red. I did have notes and discussions on the other issues in this case. I'd be happy to answer questions, but I'll share my time with my co-counsel.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Rowe.
Could
I ask, before you leave, how many units were there in the Bassingers' property?
There were three separate apartment units, if you will. One building, three units.
Just three?
Correct.
You concede that you come under the safe play statute because of that?
Absolutely not.
Why is that?
The only evidence in this case of chipping or peeling paint is within the plaintiff's unit, which was not open to the public. The safe place law says that as far as a public building is concerned, safe place applies only to those areas open to the public. This was their private unit. The affidavits, uncontroverted affidavits, indicated that Maxine Thomas, the plaintiff's mother, was given control over that unit. The owners, the landlords, Bassingers, did not retain control.
But I thought that that the definition of public building referred to any structure used in whole or in place or used by the public or by three or more tenants.
That is the law, but the case law that has described that, and I would cite to the Freon case and the other cases that we cited in our brief, that as far as a public building is concerned, is limited to areas of public access. This area, there is no evidence in this case to establish that any chipping, peeling paint was in any area of public access.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Deanne Keller.
May it please the court, my name is Wayne Yonkow and I represent Gene Matthews. I'm also prepared to address all issues, but I want to, since I have a limited time, deal specifically with the issue of what rules should be developed to apply to landlords and, in fact, property owners in general as it relates to duty. And the rule that I would advocate is that there would be a duty to take action, a duty to exercise reasonable care if the property owner has actual notice or constructive notice. And I would define constructive notice as having reason to know, as opposed to should have known, because I believe should have known implies that there's some affirmative obligation to go and figure out the situation. As it relates to what reason to know, how that term should be construed, I would advocate that the court adopt the Restatement of Torts definition as set forth in Section 12, Comment A, of the Restatement of Torts Second, and that, in essence, indicates that reason to know means that the individual would be imputed the knowledge if it was a situation where the fact that you're trying to impute, it's so highly probable that it exists it would be inferred to that individual.
Counsel, you heard the question that I put to your co-counsel.
Yes.
I own an apartment. I know that it's an old one, and I also know that there's deteriorating paint. There's a lot of chips there, and I also know from having read about the subject that there's a 50-50 chance that that paint contains lead. He said that's enough for constructive knowledge. What do you say?
I say it is not.
Okay.
Because what it boils down to is how low you're going to lower the standard of constructive notice, constructive knowledge. If you lower it too far down, you're going to envelop all property owners. And I think if you lower it down to the level that's been advocated here, and I use my client as an example. He's read newspapers. He has general knowledge from what he read in the newspapers about the hazards of lead in property. That would be the type of knowledge that any person, educated person, would have just from reading newspapers. The only other thing that's been...
Well, what more would you require than that? That he has to be sure? I would have to be sure that this contains letter, otherwise I have no duty to proceed? What if I thought, boy, there's a 75-25 chance that this contains lead? Is that enough?
Well, I think...
Where's the line drawn?
In the context of whether there should be a reason to...
A duty to inspect.
It has to be highly probable. If 75% is highly probable...
So you would say, if I have knowledge that the presence of lead is highly probable, then I've got a duty to test.
Yes. If it's a guess, a 50-50 shot, a roll of the dice, I don't think that there's a duty to test. Mm-hmm. And with respect to properties, older properties in general, as was pointed out, the record indicates that with respect to properties built before 1968, there's only a 50-50 chance that lead is present. With respect to paint peeling in general, lead paint's been outlawed since 1978, and certainly most properties have been repainted since 1978. Just because there's peeling or chipping paint doesn't mean that that paint is lead-based, because paint since that time has not been lead-based paint. As it relates to Mr. Matthews, my client, all that's been established is that, number one, he doesn't have actual notice, and as it relates to this constructive notice, all that's been established is that he has this general knowledge that would be gained by anyone from reading newspapers, and that he has knowledge that one of his other rental properties was found to have lead paint in it. And that obviously is not any type of superior, specialized knowledge that would lead to the conclusion that he would have concluded that it was probable that the property at issue here had lead paint.
On the facts, he did have knowledge that there was deteriorating paint at this premises, right? Or paint chips?
Well, I'd like to specifically comment on that. He did have knowledge that there was deteriorating paint. He received notices from the county as it relates to a Federal 8, or a Section 8 federal assistance program that during these annual inspections that take place during these, as part of that program, that there was paint chips identified, peeling paint identified. There was no reference on those forms that it was lead paint.
So that's conceded, I think.
Right. Those forms indicate that the paint peeling, paint chipping condition was promptly taken care of. The forms indicate that it was okay within the time frame that was requested for the repairs. So from the standpoint of knowledge of any ongoing condition of paint chipping, paint peeling, the record is devoid of any such fact.
Mr. Yankala, why is it not sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact based on what your client knew? Why isn't that enough to get by a summary judgment motion?
Because I believe the issue of duty is a legal issue to be resolved by the court before the matter is submitted to the jury to determine whether or not the defendant properly complied with that duty.
But what about knew or had reason to know? You don't think that creates a jury question? A question for the fact finder?
Had reason to know, I would make that akin to the standard I alluded to earlier, that being that it was highly probable. And that's an issue that would have to be considered by the court to determine whether or not there was a duty present in the situation presented that would allow the case to go forward.
So you'd have the judge determine as a matter of law whether or not the individual had reason to know? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, and I think that's what the trial court did in this case. The trial court concluded there was no constructive notice. So obviously the court concluded that there was no reason to know in my client's situation.
Yeah, and that was solely on the basis of the affidavits?
Yes. And I think it's important to appreciate these affidavits here, because if you look at them, you'll see they don't establish the age of the building. They don't establish any superior knowledge on behalf of my client. All they establish is that my client had the same type of knowledge that anyone else walking down the street would have.
Oh. Judge Merrick wrote a very good opinion and analyzed very carefully these affidavits. The question that comes to mind is whether or not this has become a trial by paper.
Well, that's always the nature of a summary judgment motion.
That's right.
And you have to apply summary judgment methodology, and I believe that Judge Merrick carefully did that. You have to look at the affidavits filed in support of the motion, and if a prima facie case is established that should be dismissed, which I think we established. You didn't have to look to the opposing affidavits. And the court did that and carefully analyzed and concluded that the plaintiff in this case did not develop facts that would create the conclusion, the legal conclusion, that there was a duty that existed on behalf of my client.
The judge ordinarily states what the duty is. The duty of care is to take action if you know or should have or have reason to know of the paint chipping, and the chipping paint is hazardous. It's lead, right?
Yes.
That's the duty. Or maybe that the chipping paint might contain lead. That's, depending on how you state it, that's the duty. And then the issue is for the jury to determine, has there been a breach of that duty? Namely, did the defendant know, or should the defendant have known?
Well, I would disagree. I would say that the initial threshold duty determination would be made by the judge. Once there's a duty, then you have to look at the situation, the context, was reasonable care exercised in dealing with the situation,
right,
that being lead paint.
And so if there's no question and no doubt and no issue of material fact and dispute, the judge makes the call. But ordinarily in a negligence case, which is a breach of duty, it's a jury question.
It's a jury question as to whether there was a duty breach, whether it was a failure to exercise reasonable care, whether there is a duty to begin with, which is the issue in this case, is a legal issue.
No, but everybody seems to agree that there was, I mean, at a minimum, they agree that there was a duty to take action if you knew or had reason to know of paint chipping, and chipping paint might contain lead. Isn't that what the trial court said?
I think that the trial court accurately dealt with the situation in a procedural context and analyzing the duty issue initially.
And is that the duty that the trial court found?
I believe that the trial court found that the duty was that there was an obligation to take action if there was actual notice or constructive notice.
Okay.
Basically adopting the majority of the jurisdictions that have considered this issue in other states.
Right. So that they said the duty. Now the question is, did the defendant know or have reason to know? Or whatever, or you can put it actual knowledge and constructive knowledge, right? Isn't that what the judge ultimately had to decide here?
Yes.
Okay. And that was a judge question as far as you're concerned.
I agree. It should be a judge question.
In all cases?
In all cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Yankella, thank you. Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is James Murray. I'm with the Milwaukee firm of Peterson, Johnson & Murray, and we represent defendant respondents Milicevic and Secure Insurance Company. Mr. Milicevic was a small landlord in Racine who owned a number of duplexes. The one in question was located at 1741 Grand Avenue in Racine. The plaintiff and his mother took occupancy of the lower flat of that duplex on May 1st of 1992 and lived there about a year and a half. Antoine Allen had been diagnosed with elevated lead in May of 1991, a full year before moving into my client's premises. He was treated in June of 1991 with chelation therapy. That was his only treatment. And since that time, his lead level dropped continuously, at least until this appeal was filed. In this lawsuit, Mr. Allen, by his guardian ad litem, sued every landlord of every property he had occupied from the time he was 1 year old, alleging these were all properties that contained lead, and lead had contributed to his condition, and that each of the landlords and their insurers were responsible. This case went through the discovery phase for, I believe, 2.5 years. Witnesses were identified, experts were identified, numerous depositions were conducted. And at the close of all of that discovery, close of identification of experts, of witnesses, of various depositions and submission of interrogatories, we filed this motion for summary judgment, in essence arguing, after all of this discovery, and now that discovery is closed, there is still nothing to implicate us in this case. The mother never claimed that Antoine ingested lead on my client's premises. No expert witness identified by any party so claimed. The mother, in fact, didn't even claim that there was chipping paint on the premises she rented from my client. His diagnosis of lead poisoning occurred a full year before Antoine moved into my client's duplex. And no one claimed that his lead level increased during the time he was a resident in my client's duplex. So we filed this motion saying, all right, discovery's over, identified, witnesses have been deposed, including all your experts. Now is the time. If you've got anything to keep us in this case, let's see it. And the plaintiff's response to that summary judgment motion was nothing whatsoever. There was no affidavit filed. There was no brief filed. The counsel for the plaintiff never even claimed that under the statute he was unable to respond. Under 80208, there's a mechanism that if a party doesn't feel yet able to respond to a summary judgment motion, he can seek leave of court to obtain a continuance or a postponement. That response wasn't obtained. There wasn't even an argument in a brief that we should be kept in the case. So the trial court let us out, as it should have done, stating at page 45 and 46 of its decision that we have challenged the plaintiff to make a showing of even the minimal facts necessary to state a cause of action, and the plaintiff having not done so, we need not be required to prove a negative, and dismissal is appropriate. We thought the plaintiff, frankly, was conceding that we had no business in the case. Then the plaintiff filed this appeal. If you take a look at the first page of his brief in the Court of Appeals below, he identifies the parties. He talks about the Bassingers and the Matthews and the parties that have settled out and declared bankrupt. There's not one mention of Mr. Milosevic or the property on Grand Avenue. So we filed a brief in the Court of Appeals, just to be sure, indicating that we thought it was appropriate for the court to dismiss us. The plaintiff had not responded below, nor at the Court of Appeals level. And in response to that, in his reply brief, finally, the plaintiff indicated, well, there are so many issues of fact in this case, we should not have been let out of the case, and the same arguments that obtain with respect to the other defendants apply to us. Still, even as of today, there is not one shred of evidence to implicate us in this case. The plaintiff has made no argument specific to my clients that we should be kept in the case. He has just said in a conclusory fashion there are lots of issues of fact, and it's too murky to let anybody out of this case. All we ask is some indication that there will be a witness that will implicate us in this case, and there has been none. I believe, Your Honors, that the trial court was appropriate in dismissing us from this case. We ask you to affirm to that extent. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Can I ask
one question? Yes. Justice Babbage wants a question.
You may not be able to answer this, but Heritage Mutual is also involved in this case. Where are they today?
Well, their attorney is here in court, Your Honor. If you'd like to hear from him, I'm sure he'd be happy to speak with you. But my client has not raised any coverage issue that's not an issue as far as we're concerned.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mwangi.
Let's stick around to the suits.
Briefly, Your Honors.
Perhaps we can first, before you begin, what about Mr. Murray's client?
Judge, in all candor, we did not avail ourselves of the statutory vehicles in order to come back later on and file our briefings with respect to that particular landlord. And as much as I'd hate to admit it, I think Mr. Murray's correct. We did not raise the arguments that we should have raised at the trial court level, and it'll be a waste of your time to argue otherwise.
So Mr. Milosevic and Secura, they should be dismissed?
Well, to the extent that the arguments they raise are consistent with the rest of the other defendants, which arguments we have responded to the extent that our response deals with and addresses their arguments, maybe not. But to the extent that there are no factual issues that the plaintiff has raised with respect to that particular landlord, yes, then he's right.
Just so I understand,
counsel, I was looking at page 24 of the summary judgment decision of Judge Merrick that was referred to, and it indicates, and he is talking about, that you submitted one affidavit in opposition to these motions. I'm assuming that is all the motions, and that you did that in the behalf of yourself as the attorney and the guardian ad litem for the minor plaintiff. and that he then says that the affidavit itself does not set forth any evidentiary facts, but identifies 26 various exhibits which are attached to it. Is there anything else, just for my information, that you submitted during that time?
The affidavit that I submitted had the 26 attachments that the court is referring to included affidavits of an expert witness, affidavit of a lay witness, maybe two affidavits of lay witnesses.
But nothing involving, and maybe this is...
Nothing involving, you mean with respect to Mr. Murray's client?
That's correct.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was nothing with respect to Mr. Murray's client.
So the only thing the judge could do as a practical matter in the summary judgment, and I'm glad they corrected me in our 80208, is to grant that because there was nothing in the record involving his client.